Welcome everyone to the Goalster podcast, where we take you behind the scenes with guests of all shades and styles and their fascinating and enriching stories about their lives, their victories, their failures, their ambitions, and of course, their books. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, your host for the duration, and today we're talking about crime fiction, hard-boiled, cozy, thriller, detective, and what makes a bestseller. Please enjoy. And to find out more, check us out on www.goalster.co.uk. And without further ado, I'm going to count to five and we begin.
Hello and welcome from springtime London. Last weekend we had a coronation. This weekend we have a train strike. All very cozy, and what a wonderful world we live in. For those of us that were here yesterday, we spoke to Alan Bardos, who writes his pacey thrillers against a backdrop of betrayal and the hard-living horrors of war. Today, we leap to the other side of compelling literature to examine coastal communities of village life, the pub, the flower show, the harvest, the lapping waves at the feet of a local lighthouse, the fish and chip shop, who loves whom, who hates whom, who pretends, who is honest, who is deceptive, who is worth killing for and why, and of course, who done it. Yes, we call it Cozy Crime. This is Goalster Inside Story. I am your host, Humphrey Hawksley, for the next hour, where we are going to dive deeply into this genre of fiction. She is also the bearer of Goalster ethos, because for many, many years, my guest forged a very successful career as a speech therapist, helping thousands, and only then, once retired, did she take up writing. But she was not snapped up for millions by a publisher or a movie studio like you read in the papers. With energy, persistence, imagination, and loving most minutes of it, she self-published, and she found readers loved her stories and her style, and we can learn how she did that. And then she did get snapped up by a young new company, which has propelled her stories to even more. Tens of thousands, maybe tens of millions. I will ask. You can ask too, because this is Goalster Inside Story, and you can ask anything you want. And welcome, Frances Evesham, to Goalster Inside Story.
Thank you very much. And I'm very, very pleased to be here today.
It's wonderful. You have a sort of, is it a bucolic backdrop behind you? Are you in the deep in the countryside?
Well, we're on the coast, so it's a small town. I live in a small town called Burnham-on-Sea, which is actually, although it's called on sea, it's actually on the Bristol Channel, where it opened out into the sea. So we have the tide goes out for miles and comes in for miles.
Oh, I see. So it's called Burnham-on-Sea and it's not on the sea. So we even begin with deception, don't we?
Well, you can walk to the sea. From our house.
Oh, you can walk to the sea. Okay.
Yes. And if you continue to walk across the beach, you might end up with your feet in mud, as people do every year.
And is this a cozy community where everybody wants to kill each other?
It's a very charming community, actually. I like it very much here.
Have you spotted a murderer?
Well, not one that I can prove anything about. But one of the interesting things, of course, is that I never want my neighbours to think that I'm going to put them into my book as one of the murderers. But sometimes it's really very tempting.
Yes.
One of my immediate neighbours, they are all absolutely lovely.
So if somebody pushes into the queue at the local store or something, you can say, you watch it or I'll put you in my book, and then they go to the back?
It's very tempting. I've never actually done it, but you never know.
Now, I want to go back before we talk about what we're actually going to be talking about. Because you worked for many years as a speech therapist, but when you were a little girl growing up, did you want to be, when you thought about the world around you, a best-selling author, a speech therapist, or let's say an astronaut?
Well, definitely not an astronaut.
Okay.
I don't like heights. And I'm not brilliantly scientific, although you need a certain element of science to be a speech and language therapist. Mm. It's a wonderful crossover career, in fact. I hadn't even heard about it when I was a child. Mm. And when I was little, I used to read the books about horses. because I wanted to ride horses. Of course, at the time, I lived in London, nowhere near any horses, and I never did get to be at a gymkhana. But I always thought I would write books like that.
Okay. So write horse books?
Horse books, yes.
Horse murder mystery books or horse books?
Well, they would have been murder mysteries because I find they're the ones that come to me. I tried to write romances a couple of times and murders kept creeping in, or at least sort of crime and mystery. So I feel that's what I'm fated to do. It must be something that happened to me when I was very young. I've hidden in my psyche.
Yes, it's a deep side. And Dick Francis, he was the great horse writer, wasn't he? Did you read him?
I have read all of his books, yes, and thoroughly enjoyed them.
Yes, but he's now gone. Is a horse racing book or a horse book a popular genre, or is it better having Murder at the Fish and Chip Shop, which is one of the titles of one of your books?
Mm-hmm. I think it's the murder bit that people really like.
Okay.
They like the idea of being murder. I don't call mine death because that always seems to be a bit near to the knuckle, you know. There are lots of sort of books like Agatha Christie wrote Death in the Clouds.
Yes.
Whereas I prefer to stand slightly back and call it murder. So, you know, I'm not actually getting my hands dirty quite so much.
Peter James uses dead in all his titles, doesn't he?
Absolutely, yes. Yes, and that sort of shy away. I mean, no objection to it.
I want to get on to the titles of marketing, all that a little bit better, but I first want to nail down, you became a speech and language therapist, but what does a speech and language therapist actually do?
Okay, well, a better title, really, which is one that a lot of us have wanted to have anyway, is a communication therapist, because mostly we're known as speech therapists, and that we think it's a kind of elocution, so that you talk nicely.
Mm-hmm.
And although that might have been where it started off, in fact, it's grown and grown and grown as a profession, until it encompasses any form of communication, including sign language and so on. And working with children, working with adults, it's an enormous and vast field of people working in speech therapy. Even, it must be about 15 years ago, I think, when doctors began to notice that people that had strokes and had gone to hospital very often had chest infections and died of their chest infections. And then when people investigated it a bit further, they realized it's because they couldn't swallow properly. Very appropriate, you're just having a sit there, because especially if you're in bed, you see, people lying in bed and they have a glass of water or something and it goes down into their lungs and they either cough it up, which we mostly do, or else it can sit there being quite nasty. So speech therapists, because we seemed to know more than a lot of people about what actually goes on in your mouth and throat. So we became swallowing therapists as well, although I never went down that route very much myself. I stuck with people with language disorders. So
when you say speech, when we hear about speech and language therapists, this is also somebody who might or probably does know, like you do, the mechanisms of how our mouth moves, how we swallow, how we eat. So it's much bigger than just speech.
Yes, that's the sort of physical side of it. And then with children, and especially with language and learning disorders, it encompasses people, for example, who we now call neurodiverse. So yes. People who have autism or on the autistic spectrum, people who are dyslexic, that's very often linked to a language disorder. And people can really have quite severe difficulty with language. Although grammar is something that we are innately used to using, it goes wrong for some people, as everything can go wrong for some people. So we do a lot of work in those sort of areas. And I think that area is growing, really, as we understand that a lot more people are neurodiverse than we ever thought before. And I have a statistic which I think is quite shocking. I did a lot of work in the criminal courts. And young offenders, 60% of them, have got language or communication or speech difficulties.
What?
Isn't that interesting?
At so least it's to do with communication, then. I mean, as you say, is that because I know some people that I know who are autistic or special needs, they will have a communications book with charts and pictures and that sort of stuff in it. So if they can't speak, they can point to what they want or how they feel.
The other side of that is how easy they find it to understand what's going on. When you have a language disability, I heard somebody once describe it as they were talking about someone who'd been accused of something in court and they were autistic, right, and had very poor language skills. And she said to the jury, imagine if you were in Japan and you don't speak Japanese, but you're picked up by the police and they're asking you questions in Japanese and you don't understand what's going on. And she said, that's what it's like for people in this country with a language disorder who are, you know, that they're confused, they're asked lengthy questions, they're asked, this is true, isn't it? And they nod. Oh, they're so confused that they say, did you do it? And they say yes or no, randomly.
So that, I mean, this is fascinating because that 60% figure is that, and these people are going through the magistrate system or the criminal system, when in fact they have a physical disability, they can't talk, or special needs that are not being addressed.
That's right. Yes, and I think things are much better now. And children in school who were once labelled a behaviour problem and probably excluded from school, people look a little bit more carefully now to see, well, if you don't understand what's going on, then you are likely to have a behavior problem. And in later life, you know, what will you do? You may not be able to get a job. You might turn to other things. So it's not an excuse.
And so in your career, when you had, you were tasked to look into people that could be suffering from that, and then do you give them a communications book, or you help them eat, to help them swallow, that whole thing?
Yes. I mean, it would be different for each person. It's a bit like the saying, if you meet a person with autism, you've met one person with autism, and all the others are likely to be very, very different. So I think a huge part of the job is actually assessing and diagnosing exactly what the needs are. And sometimes it's something really simple, like carrying a card around that says, well, I don't always understand what people say to me. Yes. And so you can show that to people if you want. Yeah. You know, yes. It's very awesome. Simple things like that can really help.
Yes. This is a fascinating discussion. Now, Self, we'll have to have you back on under a different... We're meant to be doing murder mystery now. So when you were doing this, because you did it for 30 years or so, didn't you?
Yeah.
When you were doing this, were you thinking of plots for murder mysteries, or did the speech and language environment you lived in feed your imagination, or was it a whole separate world?
Well, I did write a book a very long time ago now, which was about speech and language for children. And it's now out of print, and deservedly so, because we see things very differently these days. But that was the first thing I wrote. And I found that incredibly exciting. Yeah. And then, I don't know, somehow to write fiction was something that you don't think you can do. You think it's what other people do. You know, how do they do it? How do they put 70,000 words down without getting lost in the middle? Mm-hmm. And it seems that ordinary people can't do it. But in fact, ordinary people can and do. And these days, with self-publishing, which I know we're going to talk about a bit later, anybody can do it, really. Your books won't sell if they're no good, but you can put them onto Amazon if you want.
Yes. And we're going to talk about that in a moment, because Lillette Butler's come in with quite an injured sort of bridging what we're talking about, I feel very limited and stunted in language. Started off in German, had to learn Afrikaans when I went to school, then English for further education. Never developed any proper language. No mother tongue, Lilette. Francis.
Well, that is fascinating. I would suspect that actually you're very much better at languages than most of us are, just from having learned so many. And in fact, there's evidence that people who know more than one language and use or have used more than one language, it has all sorts of benefits. It's supposed to help with delaying the onset of Alzheimer's, if you're going to be lucky enough to have that. Right. And it helps you because you have to be very clever to go from one language to another, especially if you don't translate each time, but you live in the language that you're using. Mm. Then your brain is switching from one system to another very fast, and it's incredibly good for your brain. So I think you should
you should be grateful for your discombobulated upbringing, Lilette. But is it interesting? Mother tongue is something. Do we all have a mother tongue and then we learn other languages fluently?
You can learn two at the same time. One of my grandsons is half Brazilian, and his mother used to speak Brazilian to him when he was little, and his father would speak English. And children manage that with the greatest of ease. And when they go to school, he and his friends, they said, no, we're not going to speak Portuguese, it is in Brazil. We're not going to speak Portuguese anymore because our friends all speak English, so we're going to speak English. Mm. But he's now a teenager and is learning other languages at school and finding it easy because he's still got...
He's got that switch. That switch thing. Sue Townley asks, your surname, we think, but we don't know because we're going to the world of murder, mystery and deception, but your surname is Evesham, and one of her local towns is called Evesham. Is that a connection?
Yes, I think there is. It's actually my husband's name, so I took my husband's name, as we used to in the dim distant past. But his family all seem to have come from Evesham. There are various spellings, but it's not a very common name. And so, yeah, there was a bishop or a slightly shady bishopy kind of person who seems to have been called Evesham, and he seems to be descended from him, which is slightly...
So there is a link between Sue's town and this is your heritage. The Evesham clan or shield is on the wall of great castles or something. Mondi says, we're going to get onto the nitty-gritty of the box in a minute, but this is it. Do you get the impression that our reliance on communicating via texting and social media, particularly among young people, is limiting our ability to communicate verbally and in a more nuanced way?
I don't know. I don't have any facts and figures about it, really, but gut feeling is that it's incredibly useful to be able to do WhatsApp. And we use WhatsApp in the family all the time. And we use emojis, which is yet another language that's developing. And I don't think any of that does any harm. But I think it's very sad when people don't talk to each other as well. And, you know, I don't know whether you could have the sort of depth of conversation that you have face-to-face with people by doing it digitally. You know, I think it seems to skid across the surface.
Yes, and it's all still evolving, isn't it? Because we've now probably got a full generation since the text began. Those people that were born then are now 25 or 30 or something like that, and they've gone. And Monique, but before we move on, did you read Flaubert's series of K.M. Peyton as a child?
I didn't. I should have, obviously.
Yes. Do you know them? I don't know.
No.
Monique, enlighten us, and then Francis and I will go off and read them, and we'll critique about all that later on. So we've got, you do two series, and one is the Exham on Sea, mm-hmm. the other one is the Ham Hill. Exham on Sea was the first one, so you're
you've left your job as a speech therapist mm-hmm. and you're walking down a beach. Are you thinking that you're going to become a murder mystery writer, or what? How did that all evolve?
Yes, I was thinking about being a writer and wanting to write fiction and wondering how one even starts doing something like that. And we have on Burnham-on-Sea Beach, and Epsom is a thinly disguised Burnham-on-Sea, we have a very peculiar lighthouse. Because we have shifting sands and we're on an estuary, so the tide goes out a very long way and some of the sands go with it. So we can't have an ordinary lighthouse sitting on the sand because it would fall over. So we have one with nine wooden legs, with a sort of a lighthouse sitting on top of its nine wooden legs. And so I'm walking on there, and as writers always do, you start thinking, well, what if? And what if I found a body here under the lighthouse? And that's actually where the first book came from. And Libby, the main character in the Epsom on Sea books, she's just arrived in the area and she's walking a dog as a way to get to know people. She's walking somebody else's dog, who is a Springer Spaniel, who are notoriously energetic. And he finds the body on the beach. And the story springs out of that. And I really, when I started that one, I didn't really know where it was going to go. I just knew there was going to be a body.
So you started actually writing that opening scene, did you?
I did. Yeah. And of course, I've read loads and loads of murder mysteries. I love it as a genre because, you know, I like it all nicely tied up at the end.
Yes.
Puzzle to solve.
And now I've just put into the chat there, when we discussed this earlier, Francis, I said, what's your latest book? And you said, no, don't put my latest book in. Put the first in the series in, which is what we've done on both of those. And I noticed as we were putting them in that they are on Kindle Unlimited. They're free because you pay for your Kindle thing. So you can download those that do straight away for absolutely nothing, if you're a member of that. But tell me, why not the latest book? Everybody usually wants us to put their latest book in.
Well, I've no objection to people buying the latest book, completely. But I think it's more fun to start at the beginning because the series, they have, people call it an arc, but you know what I mean. They start off with people and the backstory grows and grows. And as the books go on, you find out things about the characters that might not be there in the first book. Not things that are desperately important, perhaps, but they grow as characters. And people do start halfway along or start with the newest one and they enjoy it. But I think you get more out of it. If you read the first one, see if you like it. Yeah. If you don't like it, you know, fair enough, read somebody else's books that you had enjoyed. But if you do like it, there's lots more to come. So you can sit down for a long weekend and go through the whole lot if you want.
Well, that's a brilliant advice because Jean Joyce has just downloaded Murder at the Lighthouse and looks forward to reading it. Thank you. Thank you, Jean, for that. And before we go on, because I'm going to ask you about the characters and the structure, we have a competition. And the competition is this, is that what is the one thing that you cannot write in a cozy crime murder mystery? The one thing you must not do as a writer, put your guess, or you might know it, in the chat. And the first person that gets it right will get a signed copy of a book of their choice. Can we do that, Francis?
Absolutely,
either series. And Francis will send it to you with a signature and a message and whatever it is. So tell us the characters firstly in Epsom on Sea. Give us the main characters and why we should love them.
Oh, okay. Well, Libby is the first character. She's the first one who appears. She's the lady who's new to the small town and struggling a little bit to get her feet under the table. You know, small towns, rural areas, coastal areas can be quite difficult. You know, people say if you haven't lived there for 20 years, you're not part of the community. And so it's quite hard for her to find her way.
And she's single and just
arrived there?
She's middle-aged, you know, getting on a little bit. She has been married. Her husband is now dead, and she's got children, but they are grown up and don't appear to start with in the books. So she arrives, and she begins to meet people, and the people that she meets are people who become very important over the life of the books, especially Max, who is a rather lovely, grey-haired, sophisticated-looking gentleman. And they are introduced to each other when he's walking dog, huge dog, a great big dog called Bear, and Bear leaps out and starts barking, chasing Libby's cat, and Libby reverses into a lamppost. And that's how they meet. And then as the books go on, they become a bit of a partnership. Max has a son, Joe, who is a policeman, because I think it's very important to have some sort of access to how things are really done if you're going to solve murders. Otherwise, you could get yourself in trouble.
Yes.
So that, you know, there is some experience there about solving murders. And as Max and Libby go through the books, the murders that happen in this part of Somerset happen in different locations, especially ones that I think are especially lovely in Somerset, which is full of wonderful places. So we have Glastonbury Tor, we have Clifton Suspension Bridge, which is a bit north, but we allowed it because it's rather a wonderful place. The lighthouse I've told you about. There's Cleeve Abbey, which is an old monastery, and the last one in the series was set there. There's Dunster Castle, there's Wells Cathedral, and then there's rural West Somerset.
Just to sort of encapsulate this in mind, you set your community or your village. You have your compelling characters, each that fill a sort of role that slots in, and then you give us for each one a beautiful or interesting place that we feel we're at, like a cathedral or a statue or something like that, which is where the murder takes place. And that sort of brings us all into the, takes us in and on the journey, as it were.
Yes, and for me, that's part of the fun of writing it, of course, because I go and research these places.
Yes, we have three guesses to our quiz question, which, and I'm going to have a poker face. I'm not going to tell you if they're right or wrong, but I am going to read them out. And the question is, what must you never write into a cozy crime murder mystery series? What must you never do, Francis? And Lillette says you cannot reveal why a person is murdered. Monique says they shouldn't have any graphic descriptions of the murder. And Jean Joyce says politics. I can understand all of those questions. Emma has come in now. I think one major thing to avoid in writing a murder mystery is revealing too much too soon and too little too late. In fact, I'm not going to tell you if that's right or wrong, Emma, but I am going to ask a question off that. Is the reveals or the red herrings? Tell us about how you do those.
Well, I do write lists of them. When I set out to write a book, I always say to myself, I'm going to really plan this book out and I'm going to know exactly where it's going and what's going to happen. And it will be so easy. And so I write lists of what the red herrings are going to be and lists of what the real clues are going to be and lists of who might have done it but didn't and who actually did do it but doesn't look as if they did, all those sorts of things. And then I start writing. And something very strange, which I know many writers find the same thing, is you find that your characters take over and you're writing this perfectly normal scene and they will suddenly say or do something that you weren't expecting. And I know that in at least two of my books, I've actually had to go back and rewrite because I discovered the person who I thought committed the murder, in fact, didn't. It was somebody else altogether. So I had to go back and start over because, it just works better. I mean, I have sort of theories about this, and I think it's your subconscious doing the work for you.
Yes.
I think it's the same subconscious that, I don't know if people have had the same experience, where you wake up in the middle of the night and you think, oh, I've got to do this thing tomorrow. And it's really important that I've completely forgotten all about it. And I think that's your subconscious working on you and saying, don't forget this and don't forget that, and keeping you on straight and narrow. And my subconscious has much better ideas than I do about who done it and why and how.
Yes. So the Lillette, you said at the beginning of the novel, I'm sorry if I miscommunicated that, because we've been speaking about speech and language therapy. I meant throughout, what is the one golden rule that you must not write in a cozy crime mystery? Sue Townley has come up with characters with complicated or similar sounding names. That's a good one, but I'm not going to tell you if that's right or wrong, Sue.
Well, I just find that it's a bit of a pitfall. I do find that I think of the same names all the time, but try not to.
Yes, yes. And I remember in Dickens sort of would keep asking people what their names are and how they spell them, because he needed his myriad of characters to do that. I just want to go back to you list on the lighthouse. There's a body there. When you write that first scene of any of them, you don't know who done it.
No, with that one, I didn't. I do these days, usually.
Or at least the character, do they change during the, well, maybe the solicitor shouldn't have done it, maybe the fish and chip shop owner should have done it?
Well, it kind of, yes. It somehow, I don't think about it in quite that way that you should or shouldn't have done it. I think it's the way that the story progresses. And when your characters tell you something, and when one of the characters who's perhaps being interviewed as a witness, and they make a remark, and you think, oh, yes, you know, that thing they've just said about that person, I haven't thought of it, but that person, you know, is a bit shifty, and let's see. And so I go down these little rabbit holes as I'm writing, thinking, well, I wonder if it would be better if it was this person or that person, or more likely, or also the how they do it, which is part of the fun, is thinking up a different way of doing it. And it's actually, I think it must be really quite hard to murder somebody in real life, and certainly not to get caught straight away. Because, you know, nowadays we have things like CCTV.
Yes, so, of course, yes. You've got a whole sort of different way of doing it. So you've got the two series. One's in the coastal town of Burnham-on-Sea, although Burnham isn't on the sea, and you've got the Ham Hill, which is internal sort of farming area. What are the common ingredients that you would need for that? Do you need a church and a pub and this, that, the other?
They help, yes. I think the people, to me, the people are what really matters. And the surroundings, you hear about the surroundings as they go out and about. But you do need a close community. There has to be somewhere where people meet. Maybe they have a historical society. And because most of the murders happen in a place where there is some sort of a history. So the people in the historical society know a little bit about history. And some of the other places where people might meet is Libby, our heroine. She's actually a cook, and she cooks all sorts of things, and she starts to work in a baker as part of her getting to know the community. And so we see her baking bread, and we see her making lots of dishes that I actually like.
You know how to make it.
That's right. And so people come into the shop, you know, people will come into the bread shop for their sandwiches, and I have a lot of fun with people's conversations and the different characters who might come in.
And so with the Burnham-on-Sea at Excellency, do you have to have sort of sea-like characters or something like, do you have a fisherman? Do you have a lifeguard? Do you have, you know, whatever a coastal is, as opposed to in Ham Hill, do you have a farmer and a fruit picker? I mean, how does all that work?
Yeah, there's definitely an element of that, especially in the Ham Hill ones, where, you know, in the countryside, I suppose people are quite defined by being a farmer or a young farmer, or keeping a hotel, as the heroine in that series does, or a pub, because in the village of Lower Hembro, which is a fictional village in the Ham Hill murder mysteries, They have the hotel, which Imogen manages, and just across the road, there is a pub, which Adam owns. And so there's an interplay between those two. And so you then have the staff of the hotel who come in, and the chefs, and the battle between who serves the best food and things like that.
And the tension here, Lilette, you can't have your murderer being likable. I'm not going to say whether that's right or wrong, Lilette, but I do like the theme. Can you have the guy that everybody loves suddenly turning out to be the murderer?
Yeah, well, yes, you could write a thesis on that one, couldn't you? I believe that people could, you know, that's a very interesting thought, actually.
Mm. Yes, I mean, because the murderer is not revealed until the end, and you have, how many possible suspects do you have in a cozy crime that we're all sort of thinking could do it?
Well, when you have a small community, of course, you start each book with, it could be absolutely anybody. So it could be a member of the historical society, or it could be one of the staff in the hotel. You know, there are lots and lots of possibilities. Usually it boils down to three or four. Otherwise, I think it would be hard to keep track of everybody and give them all notice. But, you know, when you're getting to know the people, just like when you're getting to know people in real life, you find out things about them that you aren't expecting, and they all have a side. So they might seem perfectly nice people, and then you hear them talking about somebody else, and you think, oh, that was a horrid thing to say. You know, I wonder what made them say something like that, you know, and that's kind of how it grows.
You sort of remind me, because at the weekend I was down on the Suffolk coast where I was raised, and a very old friend of mine who's now 100 and about to turn 101 was holding a gin party with her next-door neighbour, who happened to be an engineer, or was an engineer, on the BP oil rigs in the North Sea. And there was somebody at the party who ran the local garage, talking to somebody who's opening an art gallery in the West End. And I thought that in London, where I live, you don't get those groups of people together where everybody's getting on and having a free sluice of gin, but they all come from these completely different backgrounds.
Oh, I think that's wonderful. And I think that works in that, I think you've got the makings there of a wonderful kind of cozy mystery, because all those really very diverse and different people. A lot of the people in these books, because they're all set in Somerset, are Somerset types of people. As you say, there are people who fish off the pier.
Yes.
Height changes and so on. So, you know, there are people in Exham who are professionals, but there are a lot of people who've always lived there, grown up there, have sisters and cousins and aunts who all live in the same area, and very often have become divorced, are on second marriages.
Have
very complicated kinds of families, which lead... There can be a lot of uncovering of family trees and things like that when you're investigating murders to see if people are really who you think they are, or whether they're actually somebody else altogether.
And how does the... we've got your Exham community that you just told us about. Now, how does that differ from your Ham Hill community in the types of people and the plots and stories that you construct?
Yeah, the Exham on Sea people are more involved in the high street. So, you know, we have the kinds of shop owners. We've got quite a lot of shop owners there who pop up. In the Ham Hill ones, it's more bucolic in a way. I like the farming aspect. I actually come not directly from a farming family, but my mother came from a farming family. I spent vast amounts of my childhood down on my uncle's farm, with the cattle and the sheep, and I love all that. So in the second series, we do have a lot of scenes where people are talking about farming, which often is anybody who knows farms is often complaining about the weather and things like that. And sheep, I remember when my auntie used to go out in the night in the springtime in lambing season and used to be out all night. And I have to say, she used to be out all night with my uncle lambing. And in the morning when we got up, she would be cooking us a full English breakfast. So they work incredibly hard and do wonderful jobs. And I like to write about all of them. And when we got to one of the books in the second series, A Racing Murder, right, I had a lot of fun with that. More fun than I'd expected, because I put to my editor, this is what I'd like to do. We have a race course in Somerset that we have too. And, you know, I'd like to set it. And she sort of rubbed her hands together and said, well, that's wonderful, because my family have been racing for years.
Oh, my goodness.
And she knows everything about racing. So she, as this was during the lockdown, it was rather difficult for me, because I wouldn't be able to go and visit. You know, if you remember what it was like in those days, the race course wasn't racing and the horses weren't there and nobody was on the course, so I couldn't do that. But she knew absolutely everything about it. So it was sheer chance and wonderful, because I loved it. As I say, I always wanted to ride horses. I always wanted to.
So this was your childhood dream come true.
It was, yes. It was fantastic. And I could see, you know, would this happen? And she'd say, no, dear, that wouldn't happen on a race course.
When you were discussing the Ham Hill environment there against the Exmoor Sea, there was this farming, there's the lambing and the horses and the you know, the dogs and cats, I presume, maybe the badgers and the...
Oh, dogs, definitely dogs.
It is. Have you seen Clarkson's Farm?
I have seen Clarkson's Farm, and I just love it, because it's the real farming, isn't it? And look at my pretty cattle. And
I mean, there was I think I can give a spoiler for that, because I just wanted to ask about it. There was a cow that wouldn't get pregnant, and technically they have to take them off to make hamburgers out of them. But he had fallen in love with this particular cow, and he turned around to Lisa, his girl, and said, Lisa, we can't do it. We now have a pet cow. So these animals are very important, aren't they? Animal ingredients you have to or you do put in.
Well, dogs are my main ones. In fact, there's a very important dog in both series. There's the big bear. There is a Romanian sheepdog, so he's big and steadfast and can walk wherever and can be totally trusted to get Libby out of trouble if necessary. And then there's Shipley, who's a wild Springer Spaniel springing. And Libby has a cat as well, but the cat actually belonged to her husband, and he didn't like Libby very much. And she has to watch out, because she feels that he's always trying to trip her up when she's going downstairs. Oh. And will only eat salmon. So I have some fun with the cat.
So the relationship between the characters and their pets and animals is as important as the relationship between the characters.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's sort of no difference sometimes between the pets and the characters, because Libby's other great friend or who works with her is Mandy, who's a goth. So she's a much younger person, and she likes to wear goth clothes and paint her lips purple, and she has tattoos which do, and I don't know, I'm giving much away to say that at one point in the books it turns out that the tattoos are not actually real. But so she's like a third pet, really, I think.
And are the types of murders different in the two series, or is it all the same sort of style of killing people?
What people die of kind of depends where they are, because in the first series... because they take place in certain areas, like Wells Cathedral, for example, you can use what's in the area And I had a wonderful time, because one of the things we have in Wells Cathedral is a chained library, which is a very ancient library where the books have chains on them. And I had a lovely afternoon spent there with the librarian. And I said, you know, why do they have these? Is it to stop them from being stolen? And he said, well, not so much. He said, in sort of Tudor times, the canons used to take a book home and forget to bring it back. So just like, you know, if you have any old library books that you should have taken back years ago, that's what they used to do. And so they had to put what the librarian said, I don't know if it's actually true, but he said they had to put the chains on to stop the books disappearing into the houses of the canons.
what a lovely story. I just want to say, Sue Townley, his thinking again about this is the ask question. I suppose if you didn't reveal who the murderer was, that would be a no-no, that you have to say who the murderer is. I have to say that our question, what is the one thing you cannot write in a cozy crime murder mystery? Nobody has yet got that answer. And we've got 10 more minutes or so to go with it. But if we don't get an answer, I am going to ask Frances to pick out what is the best answer, because I quite liked Sue's answer there, wasn't it? It was, you know, that you have to reveal who the murderer is, don't you?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Jean Joyce, my daughter had a rescued Romanian sheepdog, the most loyal and lovely dog. Yes, Monique, I visited the chained library at Hereford Cathedral.
Oh, yes.
The same reason that would be, I presume. And Emma, you've asked a question which is going to catapult us into our final reveal of the show. Not final, because we've got many more to come. But she says, is it important for aspiring authors to attend writing courses before publishing their first work? And I think you asked earlier, Emma, about how much research you did, which we touched on a bit. You did it and you self-published, didn't you? Did you do a writing course? And tell us about how you self-published.
I didn't, actually. I mean, I'm kind of ashamed of the way I did it, because I thought, I want to write a book, so I'm going to. And I had written children's books that never saw the light of day quite a few years ago, again, rightly so. But I thought, well, I want to write this book, and I know how I want it to sort of to feel, I think. And so that's what I did. And I thought, well, nobody knows who I am. So I got one of the editing programs, I think it was Grammarly, something like that, where they help you to edit it and take out your worst mistakes. And then I put it out sort of quite gently, with no hoo-ha and big launch or anything like that. It just kind of appeared. And people would come back to me and say, well, you know, did you know that you said this and that doesn't really work? And so I listened to everybody and changed things for a few months until I felt really happy with it. And then kind of let it go with a bit more pizzazz, because I felt confident. And actually, to this day, I have an email list, and a few people on that list have said they're very willing to read my books before they're actually published. Okay. And I let them have those books.
Yes.
Well, once we've got past all the editing and they're pretty much ready to go, I give them to my readers. And they will always find things that are mistakes, always. And it's just incredibly helpful. And you think, my goodness, I couldn't possibly let that go out with that mistake that's got through 10 people already. But one person will say. I'll give you one example. Was a reader... it was a book set in Dunster Castle, and there are some volunteers in the story. And I said something about the volunteer with a cup of tea. And this lovely lady, she said to me, no, you would never be allowed to take your cup of tea into those rooms as a volunteer, because you might spill it on the books.
Yes.
And that would have been a bit of a no-no if I published it.
Yes. So, but then you put it up on Amazon, I presume. What does that process of work? And supposing, I mean, how do people get to find it amongst that sort of thousands or millions of books they have up there?
Well, they don't start with. I think you need to accept that if you're going to self-publish yourself, you're going to be hidden to begin with. Mm. But you will have one or two people who will like it. Mm. Best not friends and family, for sort of technical reasons about what Amazon thinks your kind of books are, because you don't want lots of reviews of other books and it will get very complicated. But you can put your book out quietly.
Yeah.
But if you really want to do well, it's a good idea to have three. The start off with three books written fairly close together, so people read the first one and they might think, "Oh yeah, well, I quite like this," and they want to buy another one. Yeah. If there isn't another one there for them to buy, they forget about you and they go somewhere else. So, you know, if you're thinking about writing, write three books and put them out 3 months apart, and then people will be really hooked. And when you do it, building an email list, you can do sign up. You can do it by giving them a free book, something like that, inside your list. You know, the usual sort of techniques that you use. Yes. And then you've got somewhere to start. When you publish the next book, those people will read it with an
email out of all of those people. And Monique says, do you publicize your books on social media? Do you pay for Facebook and Twitter or whatever it is advertising?
I did when I was publishing my own books. Whether it works so well now, I'd have to think about that now. There's something called BookBub, which is the big one, which is you have to be accepted by BookBub because they won't just publish anybody, but they will publish any good book. So that you don't have to have a name, you just have to have a good book. And if they like it, they will send it out to millions of people. And the first time I had a book club, I actually sent the book out for free because I had three, so it didn't matter if I didn't get paid for the first one. And that was when it started to explode and the books became very popular and something happened, and it was all due to that book club.
And how long were you doing that for before you got snapped up by your publisher?
It was about 3 years, three or four years. So I had six books by then. And what I was finding was that selling them was taking as much time, if not more, than writing them. Keeping up with it all, especially as I was doing the adverts at that time. So I had to write them, I had to monitor them, all of that. And I think when you get to that point, you either have to start having your own staff, but assistants and things like that, which is a great way of doing it, or I was just very lucky that Baldwood Books came along and said, we've just started, we've got, I think they had 20 authors or something, and would you be interested in publishing with us? Yeah. And I talked to them for a bit and said, well, actually, that would be lovely because you could do all the marketing.
All of that, yes.
Now I can sit at home and write books instead of that.
And I saw them as I was looking through them, and because I was reading The Harvest Murder and all that sort of thing, that on these books, you've got 3,000 or 4,000 reviews, Amazon reviews from. I mean, that is up on the number one bestseller list level, isn't it?
Well, they just grow. And I think part of that is having the series.
Yes.
And people want to read the next one and they come to it with a lovely open mind. And if they like your character, like I said, if they like the first book, then they're probably going to go on reading them, even if sometimes they think, oh, I'm fed up with this. I'll just give the next one a try in case it's better. You know, those kind of thought processes. And it moves it along.
Yeah. We have a couple of more answers to the question. And the question is, what is the one thing you cannot write in a cozy crime murder mystery? I have to reveal that nobody has yet got the answer, Francis and I. So what we're going to do, I'm going to read out these last two. Keep trying, keep persisting, and we will get there in the end. If not, we're going to go through the answers, and Francis will decide which one is right. So Vivian, in real life, not all murders are solved. In books, no reason authors should just leave suggestions as to who might be the culprit. Make the reader work it out without telling them. And Emma, maybe spending too much time on character development is to be avoided in writing murder mystery. That's an interesting answer. I'm going to ask you to wait there for 2 seconds, Francis, whilst I tell everybody what's coming up, if I can find it. And then we're going to go back and we're going to reveal all. We are not going to leave our people hanging on to find out what this answer is. May 15th, we have had suddenly a cancellation of Sarah Rayner, who was going to be with us for the Goals to Purpose, Passion and Grit to talk about mental health and the rest of it. And we have brought in the great Malcolm Brabant to replace. Malcolm has got a New York Times and Sunday Times bestseller at the moment, The Daughter of Auschwitz. He also had a vaccination
routine vaccination jab about 10 or 15 years ago that turned him mad for 4 years, and he thought he was God. He did a documentary about that, and he has recovered. So he's going to tell us all. He's a wonderful, larger-than-life character. He's also PBS, that's an American Network's Europe correspondent. Lucinda, May 18th, is with Eva Rice, best-selling novelist, with her new book, This Could Be Everything, a coming-of-age story, pre-Notting Hill and all that. May 19th, Lucinda is with Camilla Cavendish, a senior fellow at Harvard Kennedy School and a contributing editor at the Financial Times, with her book Extra Time, 10 Lessons for Living Longer Better. No explanation needed for that one. May 25th, we go to Hong Kong, Fortune's Bazaar and the Making of Hong Kong. I'm with Vodine England, the author, A Crazy Wild Story of the Men and Women Who Made One of the World's Most Fantastic Cities. If China thinks it can control Hong Kong, good luck, because Britain could not. Brussels, could we set a cozy crime in Hong Kong?
Yes, that would be fantastic, and especially if somebody will pay me to go and live there for a bit to grant it.
Right. I presume that applies to Hawaii and Tahiti as well, does it?
It does, absolutely. And in fact, I have a new almost daughter-in-law. They're getting married later this year, who, and the wedding is going to be in Istanbul.
Oh, and you will be there.
So I have hopes of Istanbul appearing.
Now we have to give the answer to the question, and we do not have that answer. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through, if I can find them, some of the answers, and then you're going to tell us our answer, and then you're going to tell us who got it closest. And the things are, let me see, that's Lillette Butler, can't reveal why a person is murdered. Monique, not too many graphic descriptions. Jean Joyce, politics. Emma, I think one major thing avoiding a writing in a murder is revealing too much, too soon, too little. Sue Townley, characters with complicated or similar sounding names. I like that one. Lillette Butler, you can't have your murderer being likable. I love that one too. And then, Jean Joyce said, I've got a family in Somerset and know Bernard quite well. That's not an answer. That's Sue Townley, thinking about it again, if you didn't reveal who the murderer was, would that be a no-no? You have to reveal the murderer. I think we've got them all. If we haven't, we've got the in real life, yes, again, whether we reveal the murderer, leave the reader to make it out. That was Vivian. And Emma, spending too much time on character development is to be avoided. And Trish Allman says, decapitation. Do not have any more, not too scary, says Monique. But none of those are the answer. What is the answer, Frances?
Well, the answer, which I discovered by falling into this trap myself, is never kill off one of the animals.
Never kill off the animals.
The pet animals. You can do what you like to people, but don't hurt the animals.
Right. Don't hurt the animals. And since we didn't get that, is there an answer from the ones that we had that you think deserves a signed copy of your book?
Well, I think they're all rather wonderful, actually. But I think that the one that's most vital is the one about not giving all the clues but not giving the answer. I think that would just be infuriating for people to have to work it out for themselves and never know if you've got it right or wrong. So I think cliffhangers are definitely a no-no in Codes of Crime.
A no-no. So do we know who said that? We've got, Joe's got a copy of the chat. We will get that answer, and we'll communicate with you about sending them. Or if you did say that, put it in the chat, and it's a good answer. Not killing animals. Completely agree, says Emma. There we go. We are... Oh, give us a very quick goals to tip, which we do, about retirement, empty nesting, the discombobulation of things changing in life. What do you, Frances Isham, do to keep punching in and fulfilling your dreams?
I think there's two things, really. One of them is, if there is something you want to do, then it's never too late. You know, don't let anybody tell you that you're too old, and don't tell yourself that you're too old either. I think the other thing is to give yourself a bit of space when your family leaves home and you find that everything's changed and you've given up work, that you feel you should be doing 100 things and you don't actually get them done. And I think if you just take a step back and say, I'll do a little bit of writing today and a little bit tomorrow, and we'll get there in the end, is the best way.
Don't take on too much and follow your dream, and don't say that you're too old to do it. And that's it. The clock has ticked and time's winged chariot is upon us. We all know a little bit more about constructing a cozy crime murder mystery, how to make our fortunes and sell millions, and do not kill the pets. Thank you. Thanks, Frances, so much for your stimulating comments and the comments and questions that came in from everybody. That's coming. My passion is writing, but I'm rubbish at it. No, you're not, Emma. I've seen some of your manuscript. Exactly. You obviously love what you do. Great guest. Really enjoyable hour. Thank you, Jean. Yes, we've loved it as well. But we have to go until next week with Lucinda. Stay active, stay involved, stay curious, stay safe, and of course, stay Golster. Listen to Frances Evesham Ships. And thank you, Frances Evesham, for being such a fantastic guest.
Thank you. Real pleasure. Bye.
Thank you. Bye. Thank you for listening. And find out our vast range on www.golster.co.uk. Our vision is to help people stay stimulated, active, socializing, and empowered in what we say live happier and healthier for longer. The podcast is one of many strands, which includes nutrition, yoga, art, singing, languages, brain power, love, and many, many others, more than 300, all from the comfort of your home. If you like what you hear, please press that big subscribe button and tell your friends, family, colleagues, community, and yes, your enemies too, about what Golster does. Spread the word about our incredible range of guests and subject. And until next time, goodbye from all of us at Golster.